It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, proposed legislation would make it illegal to give misleading info about polling places and times on Election Day in Wisconsin. The sponsor of the bill tells us why.
First, there's been a lot of talk about income inequality in American politics lately, including a prominent mention in the president's State of the Union address last week.
Today, after 4 years of economic growth, corporate profits and stock prices have rarely been higher, and those at the top have never done better. But average wages have barely budged. Inequality has deepened. Upward mobility has stalled.
Our next guest says while poverty and economic opportunity are important issues, a lot of the talk about inequality may be pointing us in the wrong directions. Ron Haskins joins us now. He's co-director of the Brookings Center on Children and Families and the Budgeting for National Priorities Project. He recently offered testimony to the House Budget Committee on these issues. Ron, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, you heard the president's concern about inequality there, but you warn in your testimony about politicians falling into an inequality trap. What do you mean by that?
Well, let me say first, the president was quite mild compared to the way he was in the past. He did not talk nearly as much about inequality as you might expect him to, and did not even mention the 1%, which has been a target of all kinds of, politicians in recent years. So I think he's trying to placate Republicans a little bit, trying to get something done, and hopefully Republicans will respond in kind, which, by the way, they seem to be doing. The idea is that if you cast this debate as one about inequality, it immediately leads to an argument about the poor distribution of resources in American society, about the upper 1%. Some people call that class warfare. It's not at all clear that doing something to the upper 1% is going to make poor people any better off. In fact, a lot of people in the upper 1% invest their money and choose to invest in companies, which in turn produces jobs and so forth. So it's just not very productive. We should focus on what we need to do to increase mobility. That's a much better way to frame the debate. And we need to help kids be more mobile and move beyond where their parents were.
And the president said in that clip, upward mobility has stalled. Is he right about that?
I don't think, well, it's kind of a clever word. Stalled, yes. If you want to say that upward mobility has been relatively the same for about four decades now, then it's stalled. It's been stalled for four decades. Previously, though, that's progress, because previously he said it had deepened. In several of the speeches, he made that claim, and that claim is just not consistent with the facts. There's little, if any, evidence that mobility has actually declined. It's still not good. It's a problem enough that we have less mobility in the United States than many other countries have, and it's so important. Think of this. Here's a statistic that almost everybody would agree with. A child born to parents with income in the bottom 20% of income in the United States, for a single mom, that would be somewhere around $20,000 a year. That child has a 40% chance of themselves winding up in the bottom, so twice what it would be if everything else was equal. That's the kind of lack of mobility we have in the United States, and that's something that's been hard in the last several years for Republicans to face up to. But many of them have done it and have admitted not only do we have a serious problem with equality, but mobility is not what it should be, and that's what we should focus on. We should focus our policy on promoting mobility, especially for kids in the bottom.
One argument about that lack of mobility for people in that lower 20% is a decline in maybe manufacturing jobs that would have offered a higher wage that they could get possibly without anything beyond a high school degree, and those opportunities aren't there anymore. But you're saying the statistics aren't worse now than they were before?
They're not. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office, think of them as the referee in Washington. They do analyses. They estimate the cost of bills. They give all kinds of projections about the budget. And they, from time to time, publish reports about issues like inequality and opportunity. And they recently have published a series of reports that have caused some controversy. But as I say, CBO is widely respected, nonpartisan, And they argue that if you count all government benefits and you look at the income distribution and divide it into five equal parts, called quintiles, that households in all five of those quintiles have advanced since 1979, which is exactly the opposite of what many, many people are claiming. And it's because they count government benefits. If you don't count government benefits, then the point you just made about manufacturing and the lack of increase in wages over the years, especially at the bottom of the distribution, in fact, up to maybe 30 or 40% of the distribution, there's been very, very little progress. Nonetheless, because of government benefits, and especially because of something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, all families in all five quintiles are doing better. And that really had an impact in Washington because, as I say, people have a lot of confidence in the Congressional Budget Office. And so many people have cited this report.
But including government benefits, I think you could probably get broad agreement across the spectrum that all else being equal, we'd rather have people having that upward mobility thanks to getting a good paying job instead of counting on government benefits for part of that increase.
We certainly would. But what are you going to do if there are a lot of low-wage jobs and if a lot of people have poor education? Here is what I think the heart of the problem is, and I think a lot of economists would agree with this. And the heart of the problem is that just at the moment when our economy, because of competition and because of technology, is creating jobs that require a high level of skill, much higher than in the past, that is the moment at which kids in the bottom of the distribution are not doing well in school. They're not improving. In fact, research shows pretty clearly they come to school considerably behind other children, and the schools increase how far they are behind. This applies to low-income families. Here's something really interesting. The gap in achievement, so-called, between black kids and white kids has actually declined over the past couple of decades. But the gap between kids from low-income and poor families and more advantaged children has increased for at least the past three decades. So that's why I say they are not getting the education and the skills that they need. We're in a permanent state of reform in our public schools. We've tried many, many things. We have a lot more preschool than we had in the past, and yet these huge discrepancies in achievement level get worse and worse and worse.
Let's chase that point a little further, this idea of the achievement gap, the big achievement gap in education being between the top of, like, I guess, the income spectrum and the bottom.
Not even the top and the bottom, even the middle and the bottom.
Mm. Well, in your testimony that I referred to earlier, you started offering some solutions, some policy suggestions on issues of upward mobility, the things we're talking about here, and the achievement gap was one of them. How can we start to tackle the achievement gap?
Well, a lot of people have confidence in preschool. I do, too. I have a substantial background. I used to work with one of the best-known preschools, so-called Abecedarian program in North Carolina. But you have to admit, if you look at the data, that it's somewhat discouraging. There was a national evaluation of Head Start, which is by far the nation's biggest preschool programs, and it did not produce encouraging results. There was some impact at the end of the program, but the impacts faded. Some people say they come back later. And there was a recent, very good study published in Tennessee of a pretty large-scale preschool program with the same results, very nice impacts at the end of the pre-K year, roughly when the kids were age four, but no effects at the end of the first year of the public schools. The effects had faded. So I think most people would agree that if we had high-quality preschool with high-quality teachers who were engaging the children in activities that increase not only their intellect but also their social-emotional development, and if they were working with peers who were working in a cooperative fashion and had these kinds of experiences in preschool, that could make a big difference. There are preschools like one in Boston and one in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and other places in the country that do seem to make a difference, and there are some effects that continue into the public school. So I think preschool is a big part of it. Another part I think is going to be in the long run that we're going to do a better job of figuring out how low-income kids who don't necessarily do great in the public schools – go to community colleges and other training opportunities or be in apprenticeship programs and acquire skills that will allow them to have good jobs for $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 a year with benefits. Incidentally, right along these lines, I was in Wisconsin last year in a forum that was put on by a University of Wisconsin for state legislators and their staffs, and they had several businessmen there, and one businessman said that they are losing money because they can't find skilled welders. That was the example he brought up. And that if they could find welders, they would pay them handsomely, they would have benefits and everything, but they just can't find enough skilled welders. And that's a story that occurs all across the country. The solution, I think, is to develop training programs that are focused on jobs available in the local economy that actually train kids and give them the skills that they need to fill those jobs. That would go a long way toward reducing inequality and promoting opportunity.
We're talking to Ron Haskins with the Brookings Institution about inequality, poverty, and economic mobility in the United States. We just heard one of his policy suggestions. We'll get to some more coming up in just a few minutes.
And you can join the program. Are you worried about economic inequality in the United States? And do you think the president is right to focus on the issue? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. We continue our conversation about inequality, income mobility, and opportunity with Ron Haskins of the Brookings Institution.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts about income inequality, whether it's a top issue for you, what kind of policies you'd like to change, either to address inequality or to boost income mobility, people being able to move up from the lowest part of the economy to higher parts over their lifetime. Get your calls in just a few moments. But Ron, one thing you talked about in your testimony to the U.S. House is family structure as an obstacle to mobility and to getting people out of poverty. Can you speak to the role that plays?
Yes, there's no question that this is a huge part of the problem. We have had an explosion of female-headed families in the United States over the past four decades. With a colleague at the University of Wisconsin, Maria Kanchin, we just analyzed the decennial census data since 1970 and showed a huge decline in marriage rates, and as a result of that, a huge increase in non-marital birth rates, which means a big increase in single-parent families. So almost a doubling of the percentage of kids in single-parent families. And the issue here is that kids from single-parent families do worse in general. In the schools, they're more likely to be arrested. They're less likely to go to college. There are a whole series of deficits that kids from single-parent families have. And if you have a big increase in the number of kids in single-parent families, then you're asking for trouble. For one thing, kids in single-parent families are four times as likely to live in poverty as kids in married couple families. So no one thinks being in poverty is good for children, plus all those other effects on development. So that is definitely a big part of this problem, that kids are less prepared. I've already said that the problems with education are one of the fundamental causes of the lack of mobility and the stubbornness of poverty in our society, and one of the causes is the increase in single-parent families.
So what do you do about that? I've seen arguments that we should be incentivizing marriage, or arguments that we should be providing more types of government support to those single parents. What kind of things do you think might work?
Both. There's no question that for the foreseeable future, we are going to have a very high percentage of our children reared in single-parent families. In fact, some estimates are that as many as half of America's children will spend some time during their childhood in a single-parent family. And at any given moment, over 25% of our kids are in a single-parent family. So we need to help support single parents. Many of the single parents are less skilled. They're school dropouts or maybe high school graduates, and they don't earn much. And so we have created a number of programs at both the federal level and the state level. Wisconsin is exemplary in this matter. That subsidize the earnings. Americans seem to have a lot less trouble. They don't necessarily like welfare very much. They want people to try. So if you have a low-wage job, as so many mothers do, then the public is not opposed to providing them with income supplements like the Earned Income Tax Credit, food stamps, help with child care, medical coverage for the children, and once Obamacare is fully implemented, most of the mothers as well. So we are already providing a lot of support to these single mothers, and that we should continue to do and even improve in some ways, because such a high percentage of our kids are going to be reared in those families.
I want to get to our callers and bring them on us in on this now. Stephen is with us in Dubuque, Iowa. Stephen, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to talk about the policy recommendation that your guest had about increasing opportunities for training programs, specifically welding. I have this debate with my wife a lot because she works in economic development and needs this to happen basically to fill jobs, but I work in higher education and sometimes worry that focusing too much on that specifically for low-income people is limiting their potential, especially when they can be singled out and these programs are specifically for them. So I don't think that they're a negative and that they won't work. I just also worry that sometimes focusing on that will limit their potential and not show them that they can obtain a four-year degree. So I definitely think that doing that alongside opening higher education, offering student support so that students can succeed when they get to college can be a good combination of the two solutions.
Stephen, thanks for the call. So provide lower-income people, I think he's saying, the opportunity for vocational school and four-year degrees. What do you think, Ron?
I think it's a legitimate concern. I think the data does not necessarily support the idea that we are restricting kids from going on for four-year degrees because they try to get a two-year degree or a certificate or training in some skill. But it's something we should be concerned about. I think the real concern lies in the other direction. We have so many low-income kids who get accepted to college. They go to college. They borrow money. And then they don't finish school because they don't have the skills from high school to finish college. And so they wind up carrying a fairly large student debt. And they don't get the benefit of an education to get a better job. So I think that's an even more important problem. But I'm not denying what the caller is saying is a concern. I just don't think the evidence is that it's a problem.
Back to the phones now. We've got Willem with us in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I just wanted to address the point that your guest made earlier about how, you know, income inequality, that you don't want to take anything away from the top because they're responsible for investing in creating new jobs, but there's no evidence that shows they're doing that or doing that their investment might be rare minerals in the Congo or some factory in Vietnam. Or the money travels all over the world, just like oil and other resources. It's a global market, so there's no guarantee by, you know what I mean. It's a sort of trickle-down economics, and I think that really, the beginning of this slide happened under the Reagan administration, their attack on labor, and now with education. How are you going to have high-quality education when the prevailing politics is calling teachers union thugs and disrespecting what they do and all? They get all this time off. And you know,
all right, I'm going to jump in, Willem, because we don't have too much time for a response from Ron Haskins. The main point there that it's back to the debate. The wealthy, the 1% are job creators, or no, they're not. Where do you stand on that, Ron?
Well, wait. I want to correct something the caller said. I did not say we shouldn't take money from the top. We have one of the most progressive tax codes in the world. The bottom 40% of taxpayers pay negative federal taxes because of their income tax credit and the child tax credit, and the upper 20% pay a huge percentage, over 70% of total taxes are from the upper 20%. So we have a very, very progressive tax code. And I think that's as it should be. And we have debates all the time about whether we should tax the upper, you know, 5 or 10 or 20% more, which we decided to do 2 years ago. And Republicans even agreed to that in a compromise. So we do a lot of that already. And there is no question that there's tons of investment in jobs. Now, the caller may be right. I don't know. I don't know exactly what the date is. A lot of rich people spend money on yachts and so forth, and maybe some people resent that. But I think most Americans believe that if you earn money and run a factory or invest your money, that you should be able to enjoy the fruits of your labor.
Ron, we're just about out of time, but do you think that there can be bipartisan agreement on some of the suggestions you've made without getting the divisive partisan rhetoric in the middle of it?
There will always be divisive rhetoric, especially in recent years, has shown that quite clearly. But yes, I think I'm a little bit, not a lot, I'm a little bit optimistic. Republicans have started to make proposals. Rubio, Paul Ryan, others have made proposals that I think liberals would like. In fact, I know they would, especially on expansions of the earned income tax credit. So, yes, I think there is a possibility. There'll still be an ugly debate, but that's the name of the game in Washington. But I think there could be some progress.
Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Ron Haskins with the Brookings Institution talking about his recent testimony on inequality and opportunity before the House Budget Committee.